Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance.
We are back, Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you're in Bloomington, and we're a little fuzzy, try checking us out on 92.5. And then if you're in the metropolitan of Pontiac, what's that one again, John? 88.3. We welcome all of the Pontiac area listeners who are new to Catholic Spirit Radio. We love having you. We have another fantastic guest with us today. We've been very Peoria heavy on guests. We keep asking them to make the trek over here. We have Deacon Rick Miller with us, who has been a deacon, you said, for what, 12 years now?
That's 12 years.
Yeah. 12 years, and who is also a retired physician. So we look forward to having some conversation with him on maybe the intersection of faith and medicine and some of his experiences over the course of what I'm sure is a very interesting lifetime of emergency room medicine. Deacon Rick, thank you for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
So we can clear the initial hurdle, are you a cradle Catholic or a convert?
I am a cradle Catholic. I had a Lutheran mother and a Catholic father, and from that origin, I describe myself at times as an ecumenical Catholic.
There we go. We always... typically, that's one of the main questions people always ask, right? Is, well, are you a cradle Catholic or are you a convert? What was kind of your growing up in the faith? Were you pretty? You had a split family a little bit, but Lutheran's not too far away from Catholic in at least some of the traditions. What was your faith life like, kind of growing up?
My father was raised Catholic, large Catholic family, and my father felt very strongly about going to church on Sunday and at least reconciliation once a month or so. And so he was very, very motivated to get us to church every Sunday. In fact, we would drop my mother off at the Lutheran church. We would go to a Catholic church. We would pick her up and then go to breakfast after Mass.
Gotcha.
And so it was certainly not an unusual rearing. He was very committed. If you were at home, and even when you got into college, if you were at home and spent the night at his house, you were expected to go to church with him. Once he got you to the foot of the cross, he felt, okay, you're God's problem now. I'll back off.
Now, were you born and raised in the Peoria area?
No, I grew up between East Peoria and Morton.
Okay, so pretty still close to home. So what led you then to make the decision to become a deacon a few years later?
That was a unique path. It really was not on my radar screen for a long period of time. My wife and I got very active in Teens Encounter Christ program, and we were lay directors of Teens Encounter Christ. And my wife sort of led the way in many of those circumstances. People, I think, saw her spirituality, asked her, and I was sort of brought along at times as an afterthought. And she had heard somebody talking about an orientation to the diaconate, and she knew some friends were going, and she just said, are you interested? And it wasn't something I was disinterested in. It just something that wasn't right at the forefront of my thought process at that time. It's been quite a blessing.
Awesome. What? How long have you been retired? Was this after retirement, or were you still?
No, I was still working. I have been retired now a little over 6 years, and so this was. I was still at about, 6 more years to work when we started. Actually, when we started diaconate training, I had 5 years of training. I had 11 more years to work.
Gotcha. And what brought you into the medical profession?
Oh, that was, again, another sort of step at a time. I jokingly tell my kids that I started college wanting to be a forestry major and started dating my wife and realized she probably didn't want to hang out in the woods somewhere in the boonies. And so I switched from there to an engineering program, which I couldn't stand. And I decided if I was going to work this hard, I might as well do something that sounded fun. My mother was a nurse. My mother had always sort of urged a sense of considering medicine, but had never pushed it real hard. And so then I read in the late 60s a number of the books of a physician by the name of Tom Dooley, who went to St. Louis University and had actually begun missionary work in Southeast Asia. And so, you know, it was one of those – it wasn't a a metanoia. It wasn't a sudden jolt of say, hey, let's do this. It was more of an evolution.
Gotcha. And your medical area of expertise would then be what?
Well, my initial interest, I actually taught school for a year before I went to med school. My initial interest was pediatrics. And my wife and I had been married at that point. In fact, we started medical school with a three-week-old child.
I bet that was
which fun. If any of you are ever considering going to medical school, it wouldn't be the first thing I would recommend. By the time I graduated from medical school, we had two kids, and we were living in a mobile home. And I finally, talking to another family member, we decided to buy a small chunk of property south of Tremont and build houses. So when I went to drop out of my pediatric residency, they offered me a job working in the ER. And so it was like, I like this place. And so it was initially to pediatrics, then to emergency medicine. And it's kind of an interesting, you know, I look back and say, I really enjoyed this. I had a good time.
So emergency medicine is where you focus then kind of for the rest of your career?
Indeed. I'd finished, actually, I worked in the emergency department. This was long before you ever had board certification in emergency medicine. And I'd worked there for about a year and a half while I was working on a house, and then went back and finished my PEDS residency. Still worked in the ER part time. And then I got offered a job in 1980 of being the director of the emergency medicine residency program at OSF St. Francis. And with that, it was kind of like, this is fun. This is something I enjoy doing. I was combining teaching. I was combining working in an environment that probably took me about 10 years of working there that I realized that it was a really smart choice because I sort of self-diagnosed myself as someone having adult attention deficit disorder. And there's no better place to take attention deficit disorder than the ER. You're constantly being interrupted, and quite frankly, your interruptions are usually more fun than what you were doing. And so it was
squirrels running everywhere.
That's right. And so I found that something that both fit my interest and personality.
My wife self-diagnoses all the time, but she only has a doctorate in Google.
I gotcha. Well, Google has now moved to the forefront of many people's self-diagnoses.
Yeah, I'm sure it's interesting for doctors today. I'm sure they have a lot of patients that walk in and say, well, I already know this is what's wrong with me.
There's nothing wrong with patient education. I was one that actually encouraged people to know what they were doing. I'm not a big fan of physicians who say, I'm the doctor, don't ask me any questions.
Yeah, it's a mutually symbiotic relationship is always better for the patient, probably.
Yep.
What did you see kind of jumping into that intersection of faith and medicine? How did those two play a role for you? Did you find that they were at odds with one another at times, or were they pretty mutually?
Well, so certainly as you become more comfortable in medicine, you realize that it's very, very important to be there with God. God is one part of the step of beginning to understand the process of healing. You know, many times when we ask Jesus to heal us, we're really not so much talking of our broken leg or our pneumonia or our leukemia. But I think many times we're asking God to heal us so that we might be appropriate of spending an eternity with him in heaven. And so the healing that we seek, and some people lose track of that. Some people only see the physical healing. But when you recognize that the spiritual healing is a, you know, very important step in the process, you begin to recognize the importance of that.
And you spent a lot of time, you said, at OSF. Was that exclusively in, were you exclusively in OSF networks throughout your career?
I worked at some smaller hospitals too, but I was employed at OSF from full time from 1974 to 2012.
Obviously, a large percentage of hospitals are owned by Catholic organizations. Do you think that there is a substantial difference in the way patients receive care, or the way that that they're treated from Catholic hospitals versus maybe secular hospitals?
Well, I think that, you know, and just going to a Catholic hospital is no guarantee that somebody's going to sit down and talk to you about God, but it increases the likelihood that somebody, that pastoral care will be present for you. It increases the likelihood that you'll have that opportunity. I once, and I must admit, when you're a young physician, you have this tendency to, you know, to want to have separation of church and state, if you will. And I was asked once to do a presentation for a National Teens Encounter Christ Conference on adolescent suicide and depression. And the Catholic nun who was in charge of Tech and Peoria, absolutely wonderfully delightful lady named Sister Jackie Schrader, asked if I would do this. And it was about an hour, and we had a room full of folks. And she asked me later how it went. And I said, well, it was really enjoyable to bring God into the discussion, to talk about God's role in the healing of us spiritually, in the healing of our pain, and the healing of our depression, and the healing of us feeling hopeless and useless. And I said, I really enjoyed doing that. And she looked at me as only she could, and she goes, well, why don't you do that all the time? And it was like, that's probably a really good idea. And so, you know, as you begin to have this sense that it is not only appropriate but very needed to take God with you, medicine becomes even more enjoyable.
Yeah, you know, one of the things as a convert, I find, I guess, very not only appealing but also reassuring in the Catholic faith is the idea that there's a redemptive quality to our suffering. And I would think that in medicine, that if people understand that there's a reason why things happen and that there's a reason why, you know, their bodies aren't always perfect, that might also bring them either maybe more hope or maybe more understanding that might impact in a positive way their physical healing.
I don't get too hung up on the reason, because then somebody wants to know, well, why did everything go good for this person and not for me?
Sure.
What's God punishing me for? You got to remember that much of the reason stuff came out of the Old Testament, when we had a very vengeful God. And if you got sick, if you had leprosy, you know, if your child died early, you must have offended God. I quite frankly try to get away from that. I have seen a number of people die who I knew very close. I pronounced dead the 15-year-old son of godparents of my oldest child. And his only response at the end of that evening in the ER was, how does anybody who doesn't believe in God get through this? And so I when someone talks about their pain and frustration, I say simply, God understands. His own son suffered, and yeah. So he understands pain and suffering, and I think that's the only thing I think that God will ask us to do is to understand that he knows about pain and suffering, and that we can offer it to him. But I have never seen somebody who I wanted to say, there's a reason why your kid's dying of leukemia.
Sure.
I'm very, very cautious with that. I think it is much more that God gives us the ability to deal with all things if we are only open to it, and whether that ability is through prayer. It's one of the things I began to be very much aware of is that when people, when particularly adolescents, consider suicide, They've stopped thinking about God. They've stopped thinking about what God offers to them and that God loves them unconditionally. And so, I'm very cautious when I ascribe reason to poor health. And so I guess that's a catch word for me when somebody says, what's the reason this? There is no reason other than God let, man let evil into the world a long, long time ago.
Sure.
And God gives us the strength to deal with disease and suffering and sudden death. But God doesn't have a reason that he gave us that.
What are early on in your career, you said that you you thought that there definitely needed to be a separation, or you thought that there was a separation, maybe more so between the faith and the medicine. What are some of the events maybe that happened for you in your work that started to break that down?
Well, I can remember very simply. One, I went to work on a New Year's morning. And you know, New Year's Eve and early morning on New Year's is usually a bit of a mess in the ER. And they had a patient who wasn't very sick, but he was found sleeping on a sort of a bench. It was a fairly mild New Year's. And in his sleeping, he was clutching an unopened bottle of gin, just sort of laying on the bench. And I walked into him and, and he was just starting to wake up, and I just looked at him, kind of smiled and said, "Good morning, Caleb. How are you today?" And he looks at me and he says, "I am fine. But first, in this new year, I want to wish the blessings of the dear Lord on you and your family." And I just stopped for a minute and smiled, and I said, "Wow, what a way to start the new year." And then I looked at him and said, "Caleb, would you like breakfast?" And so you have this sense that patients are willing to bring them, bring God with them. And so why should we as physicians ignore that? And I became very, very comfortable saying to anyone of any faith, "Do you believe in a higher power? Do you believe in the presence of God?" And then we'd start a little conversation whether I could call someone that they had great faith in or something like that. So, it was I became very, very comfortable with the ability to bring God into the process. And for a while, you think you should just stay to the science of medicine and let people find God on their own.
Which I would think, even from your perspective as the physician in the room, it's probably, I would, to your point about you utilizing our faith in order to cope and get through life, and that as a physician who doesn't have that faith background, that it would probably make the job that much more difficult.
You see burnout in all professions. One of the things that I would talk to our residents about is that the term "going postal" came out of people having to do highly repetitive work with demanding schedules and productivity checks and getting no feedback and no positive feedback. And you recognize that we should be looking for that positive feedback, whether it comes for patients. And I would say to someone, the same place that can burn you out should re-energize you. You should look around at what you're doing and find something there that you say, "This is good." And then it doesn't take too long when you say, "This is good," to say, "God is good." This is good because I can see God in it. And I think that's the element that we want to try to bring to the healthcare profession. If we stay away, if we don't bring God in, we haven't made it as good as it can be.
Absolutely. Well, we are having a fantastic conversation with Deacon Rick Miller, who is an emergency room physician, or was a retired emergency room physician, from OSF St. Francis, and a deacon over in the Peoria area. We appreciate him being with us. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5.
Do you listen to Catholic Spirit Radio?
I sure do.
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Whenever I have the opportunity.
Of course I do.
Very much so.
Yes.
course, I listen to Catholic Spirit Radio.
When do you listen to Catholic Spirit Radio?
In the morning,
over my lunch hour.
On my way to and from work.
I listen in the car.
Usually, I'm on my way to church, and I listen again on the way home.
I listen to Catholic Spirit Radio in the middle of the night when I wake up and I can't sleep.
Tell others to join the growing number of Catholic Spirit Radio listeners. You can hear them on the air, online, on the free app, and on Alexa. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Follow them on Facebook and check out the resources on their website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com.
We are back, Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. Again, if you are just tuning in, you've missed a fantastic conversation with Deacon Rick Miller. I would encourage you to check us out on iTunes or Podbean. You can listen to the podcast. Or if this is Saturday at 3 o'clock, you can always tune in on Sunday at 3 o'clock and catch the first part of our conversation. Deacon Rick is obviously a deacon over in the Peoria area. He's been a deacon now for the past 12 years. A retired emergency room physician who spent most of his time at OSF St. Francis. Again, thank you so much for coming. We've had a lot of conversation around your impact of your faith on your medical practice. How about the opposite? How do you, in retirement now as a deacon, how do you maybe see when you do spiritual counseling for folks, or you have conversations with folks, do you see that your medical history continues to kind of influence how you deal with people as a deacon?
Well, we talked a bit during a break about this concept of redemptive suffering, that somehow our suffering can be translated into Christ's suffering. And for people, when they are acutely ill or injured, they find great difficulty in that. I think others slowly grow and become aware of that. But it's not something that they want to hear, okay, now you're sick, this is going to hurt, but remember, Jesus hurt, so buck up.
Sure.
Sort of thing. And I think it's helpful to just gently allow them to explore the concept of what did God see in allowing his son to suffer? What did God recognize in that suffering? I think he recognized a sense of faith, a sense of someone who said, I trust in you when you have that suffering. And I think that many times if we begin to consider a trust in God when we suffer, we have a feeling that God is going to be present with us through the process. Now, the one thing we haven't talked about, this happened probably 15, maybe 20 years ago. On a Saturday morning in the ER, we had just had a really heavy wet snow the night before. Not unlike, of course, it wasn't quite as wet this time. But the ER obviously has its own little sense of humor, and so there was this little discussion, like, should we alternate taking care of people this morning who are having heart attacks because they were out shoveling wet snow? And then probably like about a half hour later, got an ambulance call. Someone was coming in with a 50-plus-year-old gentleman in full cardiac arrest. The gentleman was brought into our resuscitation room. We began the process of doing resuscitation. This is a very standard process for creating an airway, continuing CPR, giving medications. And we were getting little response. And on our first trip down to the, you know, when you see that this is probably not going well, you typically try to make 1 to 3 trips to the family. First trip down, I walked in a room, and this was a room full of people screaming and yelling at one another. When did you see him last? Why did you do this? Why didn't you call somebody? Why didn't you tell somebody? Very, very angry family was sitting in that room. And obviously, I went down the second time because we were getting absolutely nowhere and had to inform the family, and they just erupted. There was incredible anger and frustration within that family. And so I did what any normal emergency physician will do. I looked at the nurse and said, you better call pastoral care. That was taken care of. And, you know, about an hour, maybe an hour and a half later, another ambulance, another call, another fellow in his late 50s coming in full rest from shoveling snow. And we went in, and it looked very, very similar to what we had seen the first time. We started the process of airway and CPR and medications, and we're getting nowhere. And I walked down to the room, and you can imagine how enthused I was to going into the room, another room just like the first. And they were holding hands praying. It was quiet. It was peaceful. They began to share little bits about their loved one. And they continued to pray, and we had an identical outcome. The patient did not survive. I walked down to the room to share that, and they asked me to join them in prayer. And, you know, and the only thing that you could see any different, I mean, this was like an experiment that you did not want to conduct, you know, a controlled experiment with God, without God.
Right.
What would you want to do? And, you know, and the outcome was so clear, you really didn't need to conduct the experiment 100 times to determine if it was scientifically significant. You simply looked and said, well, if you believe in God, if you trust in God, then God gives us the strength and the will to deal with and to handle all things. You know, there wasn't a reason either one of those guys died.
Yeah.
The reason that one family reacted differently versus the other is that family had an incredible faith in God and in a higher power.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. And you had said something earlier about probably being prepared with that faith as you come into difficult circumstances, that we're more prepared when we have that faith originally. In an emergency room, probably like an airplane with a lot of turbulence, I'm sure you've seen some conversions to faith through people that are in a particular situation. That
I think you may see an evolution. You know, I have never seen a St. Paul knocked off a horse type thing in the ER. But I think you see a sense of where people sense that God is present and they are in the presence of God and people accept that, I think that you begin to see that they recognize that God is very important to be involved in the process with them.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. What are some of the things that maybe have happened? You had given us a couple for instances. Are there any other really key moments where you could tell that God was present, kind of like you've done Curcio, I'm assuming, right?
I'm the spiritual director of Curcio.
That's what
for
I thought you had said.
Yes.
So every week at our reunion group, we ask when we felt most closest to Christ. Did those moments happen often in the emergency room where you just almost a palpable sense that?
I think sometimes the rush of emotions, the challenge of what you're facing, obscures God, and only people recognize God when they step back a step or two and go, God was present with me. God was there. I don't think that we ever see that sudden flash of, oh my goodness, God is here. That sort of a sudden awareness. But I do think that people have a tendency when they are surrounded by other folks who are compassionate, who are kind, who are empathetic to their concerns, who seek to be of service to them at a great moment of pain. I've seen people have responses that almost become catatonic. I remember a patient long ago who died in a car accident, and there was some question of whether or not this was actually a suicide attempt. She pulled into the path of a large truck. And I can remember sharing that, or just sharing with the family, but finding that the family was in such pain, just being told that this patient had died. There was conflicts within the family. There were challenges. Some of the most difficult problems that occur in the ER is when there is a family argument that morning or the night before. There's no resolution. Somebody leaves and has an unexpected event that morning, that afternoon.
Sure.
There's no ability to resolve this. There's no ability to the family to reconcile a bit. And now they're confronted with someone who is gone. And so those type of things, one just simply has to listen. You know, much of letting people find God, you know, it's sort of like the issue of spiritual direction. I think more people don't go to spiritual direction simply because they think it's somebody who's going to sit down and start at a point where they should turn left, turn right, and stop for the next 2 weeks or whatever.
Right.
I think that we have to realize that spiritual direction is two people discussing where God is in their lives and how to be more open to God in their lives. And so, you know, the spiritual director and the spiritual directee are both engaging in spiritual direction. And that's, I think, is a big challenge for people to recognize the importance of that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you know or don't know. Isn't one of the miracles attributed to Archbishop Fulton Sheen, did that happen at St. Francis? Are you familiar with that?
I have not. You know, I have not seen any of the ones that are attributed. I do. In fact, I spoke to someone about a week and a half ago that wanted to contact the folks involved because she had been praying to Fulton Sheen about a grandchild. And she was having very, very positive outcomes to that prayer. And she felt very strongly that this was a potential intervention
yeah.
on the part of Fulton Sheen. You know, I don't know of any specific cases that have been, you know, and the church tries to go through this whole process
yeah.
of how do you verify something is a true miracle, if you will, that can be attributed to the intervention of somebody who is quote-unquote applying for sainthood. Obviously, you hear lots of stories and you hear lots of anecdotal type information, but I don't think that is in the same way, shape, or form what has to be looked at in terms of a miracle. So I've never been involved in the process of trying to verify when something is quote-unquote miraculous versus something is still it was a possible outcome to a very challenging illness or disease process.
Yeah, there's always the potential for, I guess, some spontaneous recovery or...
Well, there's, you know, we have all seen recoveries that we don't understand. We have all seen people die that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And so I've long since gotten away from the sense that there is a definite reason. You know, it's, if somebody smokes two packs a day for 20 years, you kind of understand why they get lung disease.
Right.
Okay. But there is no definite way of, in my estimation, many, many times, of trying to explain
some
of these
time.
Events. Of, yeah, sometimes it's your time, and sometimes there is a very, very positive outcome when a positive outcome wasn't expected. And so, you know, that's very – you try never to take away people's hope. But you also try to say this, here is what we're facing. And, you know, and many people want to hold on to that shred of hope. You know, and I think as long as that person has a blood pressure and a heart rate, that people should share time with that person, that people should sit at their bedside and talk to that person. We don't know what that person hears or doesn't hear. And I think that's the element that the hope you want to give people is this is your time to spend with your loved one. There's a certain degree of closure that you can address while you're sitting at the bedside of somebody, even if they're not responsive. And I think that's one of the things that people should be encouraged to do.
I mean, I think you see a lot of people that will go and visit and speak to relatives at the cemetery.
Right.
So why not go and speak to them even if they can't respond when they're before they die?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the definition of death. Obviously, most Catholic hospitals, et cetera, when there is no blood flow to the brain, when there is no activity in the brain cells, and that's been double-checked over a period of a day or two or three, most people would concede that is death. You're just not keeping a heart pumping, et cetera. But we don't know what that person experiences. If for those of us who very strongly believe that there is life after death, which is what Christ kept trying to share with us, is that we have to quit applying our human understanding to what God does. And sometimes our human understanding is woefully inadequate to interpret God and his actions, etc. And then there is that sense of reassurance that we will know much more about God if we are fortunate enough to find ourselves sitting in heaven for an eternity.
I know over the last handful of years, there have been a number of movies that have come out on like near-death experiences. Yep. And that type of stuff. Any experience in the emergency room with, you know, somebody coming back to life and saying they saw Jesus? Or
not really. And quite frankly, when we'll have people come in whose heart isn't beating or his heart is fibrillating, and we'll get their heart beating again, and we have them wake up. And what you're trying to do is get them the first and foremost. Do you still have pain? Do you still have, we don't begin to ask them at that moment. I think later in their time in the hospital, they may begin to talk about that there was this blackness, there was this curtain, and then there was a great light that's been talked about for many, many years. People having this sense of a bright light when they have this near-death experience. But in the ER, those are the types of things that rarely get discussed.
Yeah.
It just simply you get
your first question isn't whether or not they saw Jesus.
Your first question is, are you having any pain? Because you want to get pain under control. Pain is a sign that they're still having heart muscle. It isn't getting enough oxygen. And so you try to deal with those things that you can treat or should be treated initially. Yeah. And then as time goes on, if they're talking to pastoral care 2 days later, I think it's a great question.
Yeah.
In your first contact, you're not you're really trying to continue to treat whatever was the process that caused them to have this bad event in the first place.
Absolutely. Well, we so appreciate you being here with us, Deacon. Again, we've been having a conversation with Deacon Rick Miller from the greater Peoria area. And so we appreciate you being here with us. If you're just tuning in, you missed it, go back and check us out on Podbean or iTunes or on CatholicSpiritRadio.com. We will be back after another short break. You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
You're listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
God doesn't send anybody to hell. We choose hell. What God is doing is allowing our free will choice. He never wants us to say no. He always wants us to be in love with him. And people need to understand, after we die, you only got two choices, heaven or hell.
Beauty.
Smoking or non-smoking.
Exactly. That's it.
Morning Glory with Gloria Purvis, Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, and the Morning Glory team.
Monday through Saturday at 6 a.m. on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Can someone explain to me, please, the attraction, if not the obsession, that some Catholics have to unapproved apparitions of the Blessed Mother? I'm not talking about approved apparitions like Lourdes or Fatima or Our Lady of Guadalupe. I'm talking about the unapproved ones, the ones with strange features that make them unlike any of the approved ones. I'm talking about scores of unapproved claims of apparitions. According to the spiritual masters like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, The desire for sensible signs and wonders is a mark of spiritual immaturity that the evil one is eager to exploit. We have the Eucharist, we have the Bible, we have the Catechism of the Catholic Church, Lectio Divina, the Blessed Mother, the Doctors of the Church, the messages of approved apparitions. So why do we need to keep chasing unapproved apparitions? Is the Catholic faith in its fullness really not enough? This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
We are back, Catholic Spirit Radio. This is Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley. I want to thank Deacon Rick Miller from Peoria for coming over and having a conversation with us today about his experiences in the emergency room at OSF St. Francis and how his faith and medical career intersected. We appreciate him being on with us. We're going to get to the readings for this weekend, which is the second Sunday in Ordinary Time. We're back to Ordinary Time. We have a few weeks here before we get to Lent, which I hope everyone is starting to think of what they're going to give up for Lent. What is Ash Wednesday this year, John? Do you know? March 7th? 8th? I think it's March 8th. Pretty sure. 99% positive. It's March 8th. So we got, I don't know, what is that, 6 weeks left to make a decision on what we're going to give up for Lent this year. A couple things that had come to my plate recently. Yesterday, actually, I watched a video on the Ember Days. You familiar? Not with the Ember Days. So I saw a picture on Twitter of 1952 Catholic requirements for fasting and abstinence. Of course, the big one on there was no meat every Friday, right? Which I know some folks that still do. I'm thinking about, I'm considering giving up meat every Friday. But the other one that was on there was Ember Days, which I had no idea what Ember Days were. I've talked a little bit about Dr. Taylor Marshall and his YouTube videos, and so I went to YouTube, which is that's my go-to place for learning about new stuff, I guess. I would rather watch it than have to read it. If I'm in the car driving, I can listen to, you know, a video. And so I typed in Ember Days. Of course, Dr. Taylor Marshall had one that came up, and I trust his Catholic experience and opinion. So I watched it, and it was very interesting. Basically, starting in about 200 A.D., the Catholic Church recognized four times a year, known as the Ember Days, in which it was a requirement that the Catholic faithful fast and pray specifically for vocations and for good holy Catholic men in both the priesthood and in our daily lives. And so it would occur four times a year. It was in Lent, in June, in September, and then again in December. So it centers somewhat around the seasonal changing. And basically, it was a requirement at the time. It was eliminated after Vatican II, but we would fast on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday for those four times a year. So you would have a 3-day fast, but it would be interrupted by a Friday, in which obviously at that time you were not consuming meat, so you could eat regularly on Friday, just abstain from meat, but you would fast Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday and pray for vocations and for holy men to the priesthood, which obviously, with all of the issues that we have going on these days, I think would be a huge benefit. It's something that I am considering, that I will probably start to do, this coming Lent. I believe The first one is the Ash Wednesday, Thursday, and then the Saturday. I believe that the first set of Ember Days is the first week of Lent, but I'll check on that and make sure. But basically, it's just a time for reflection. And again, it was something that from about the year 200 until 1966 or whatever was a requirement in the Catholic Church. We have basically completely eliminated fasting from our faith. There's not a lot of fasting. And I think that if you look back, especially from the church fathers and, you know, through all of the doctors of the faith, Aquinas, St. Thomas More, huge emphasis on fasting and prayer. And so to me, I definitely think that there's a huge benefit there. I think it really helps to clear our mind so that we can be more in contact with Christ and through the Holy Spirit. I know we've had a lot of conversations about signs and hearing the voice of the Holy Spirit. I think that through fasting, we can definitely become more connected. So I would encourage you to check out the Ember Days. I would encourage you to check out or think about participating in the Ember Days or participating in abstinence of meat every Friday, as a way to, you know, really come back and be more connected to our faith through, a very mild, physical suffering. Again, I've said previously that I think one of the biggest benefits or one of the best beauties of the Catholic faith is the idea and the understanding of suffering as a way for us to tie ourselves and our experiences to Christ and to his suffering on the cross. And so, again, I would encourage you to check out the Ember Days, get some more historical background. I thought they were very interesting. And then, you know, consider taking part in those. We have, I read an article today on the difference between mercy and justice. We had a conversation at St. Pat's Amerna last Friday. I've been attending a TGIF. I don't know. I'm assuming it. Thank God it's Friday. It's a men's 5:30 in the morning group. And so that we can be out of there by, I think, 6:45. My wife likes it because the kids aren't up, so I can get up in the dark and go and come back and then help with getting them to school. I think that's kind of the plan. The conversation that we had last week specifically was about mercy. And the conversation in the small group of guys that I had at my table was really, where's that difference? Where's that line? Or what is the intersection of mercy and justice? And so I'd done, you know, some reading and some research to really kind of figure out, to answer some questions that I, you know, that I would share with those guys is, okay, well, you know, we're called to forgiveness. But when we're called to forgive people in our lives, which 100%, I mean, I think we should do. We shouldn't carry around burdens and angers and frustrations. But when we ourselves are forgiving, we're forgiven through the sacrament of reconciliation. And part of that sacrament, or the entirety basically of the sacrament, is understanding and acknowledging our sins and going to the Father and asking for forgiveness and offering penance and an acknowledgement that we did wrong and that we're going to try not to do wrong anymore. And so a lot of the conversation that we had at our table was, if that's the model for forgiveness, that model includes me accepting that I was wrong and asking for forgiveness. And so then how does that really translate into interactions that we have one-on-one with people in our lives who may not accept that they've done things that are wrong or who may not seek forgiveness from us? And so I think we've really gotten to the point where we have tried to no longer see God as a just God. We've just tried to subscribe mercy to him. And I think that a lot of the issues that we have in our faith and in society comes from that idea of Well, God's no longer a just God. That was all Old Testament. Now he's just merciful. And I think it's very important to understand that you can't have mercy without justice. And for us to basically be merciful to those people around ourselves, to other Catholics or to Christians or to non-believers at all, if we simply avoid conversations about sin because we think that we're being merciful, we're not actually being merciful at all. We're allowing them to continue to be in a place where justice is not helping them turn their life around, and therefore we're not truly being merciful. We're avoiding the difficult conversations, we're avoiding the difficult relationships in our lives, not because we want to be merciful to them, but because we just want to make things easier for ourselves. And so I think that it's really important, you know, to start to recognize when we hear society or our faith talk about mercy, that we don't forget that that mercy is the other side of a double-edged sword with justice. And that if you just look at how God laid out our forgiveness of our sins through the sacrament of reconciliation, you can see that there is very much a justice in understanding our sins, accepting those sins, coming to the Father and asking for forgiveness, turning from those sins, and doing penance as reparation for the damage that we caused to the relationship with the Father. And we're not doing justice to those people in our lives that we allow to, through the idea of mercy, just skip that entire process. We're not making them better people. We're not helping them get to heaven, which ultimately is our goal for ourselves, and our goal, I would assume, for all those people that we interact with that we're family and friends, is to love those people and to love them all the way to heaven. And we can't do that by lying to them to avoid the hard conversation. So do some Google searches. Check out Ember Days. Think about abstinence of meat every Friday, and maybe, you know, Google search some mercy versus justice articles. There's some good ones out there that I think do a really good job of just kind of explaining that. We're going to jump into the gospel reading. This is the gospel according to John chapter 2. It's the wedding of Cana. So we're going to jump into that. I hope everybody has a fantastic week this week. You got 6 weeks left, give or take, based on our rough math, to figure out what you're going to give up for Lent or what you're going to do extra. Don't forget, you can always do extra, or you can do both, give up and do extra. So this week, the gospel according to John chapter 2. There was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. When the wine ran short, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servers, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for Jewish ceremonial washings, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told them, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it. And when the head waiter tasted the water that had become wine, without knowing where it came from, although the servers who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves good wine first, and then when people have drunk freely, an inferior one, but you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs at Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory, and his disciples began to believe him. The Gospel according to John. I think there's a lot of interesting things. Obviously, this is a very well-known gospel reading. It's one of the luminous mysteries of the rosary, right, John? Luminous. Yeah, he's shaking his head. And so I think it's very common for most people. one of the things that has always impacted me is at the beginning when Jesus says, "Woman, what is this concern of mine?" I always thought that that was a funny retort to Mary asking Jesus to do something about the wine shortage. But I think it's very telling, again, in that we are called to come to Christ, and he knew that they were out of wine. He could have fixed that. But it took his mom coming to him and pleading for others. And so I think it's important, again, for us to come to Christ with our needs and our concerns and have that relationship with him where we can ask for the things that we need. Even though he already knows it, there's a bond of a relationship that's built there through those conversations and through us knowing that we rely on God for all the things in life that we need. The other thing that I always think is funny, because it's 100% true, is the fact that the waiter says, "What are you doing? Everybody serves really good wine first and then the cheap wine later." And I have no idea how many parties in my lifetime I've hosted where, you know, we start out by serving Bud Light from a keg, and then the next keg that we load up is actually Busch Light, and you just keep serving it to people. Right, John? John has no idea. It's 100% true. There's so much truth, real world truth in the Bible that just impacts our daily lives. I wonder if I do that because I'm being biblical. Not cheap, but biblical. The next time somebody calls me out and goes, "Dude, why we had Bud Light for the first keg, now we're drinking Busch Light," I'm going to go, "Hey, it's in the Bible." So, again, 100% appreciate all the guests that we've been having on the show recently. We've had some fantastic ones. I would encourage you to go back and check out Podbean or iTunes or the website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and download our podcasts. Send a note to John Hall and let him know how much you love hearing Jason Bramley on the radio. That way he'll just start replaying the show every day of the week. And when you send him the letter, put a check in there so that you can help support the radio station, because we firmly believe, and I think all of you do too, that we're truly doing a great service to our Catholic, our Christian, and our non-believing community that listens to us, that they can hopefully become more connected in a relationship with Christ. And, you know, that doesn't come for free. We have to pay to keep the lights on. We have to be able to pay the electric bill to broadcast my beautiful voice out to the masses, including now the masses in Metro Pontiac, which, again, we so thank you for having us be a part of your day. We will have your priest on from St. Patrick's Church in Pontiac. Is that right? Now, wait, you told me that, and now you're looking at me like I'm wrong. St. Mary's. I thought it was St. Mary's. St. Mary's School.
Yeah, St. Mary's.
Okay. We don't know where St. Patrick's coming from. It's two in Bloomington. But so St. Mary's in Pontiac. So we look forward to having him on. This is Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley.
You've been listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance. Download our podcasts at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.